This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silenced them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 96, Tegan Skiba, part 2. Last week, I told you the first part of the story of Tegan Skiba, who was left to live in a shed in Smithfield, North Carolina, for a week in July of 2010. During that week, her mother's boyfriend, 21-year-old Jonathan Richardson, subjected the 4-year-old to every imaginable form of physical, psychological, and sexual torture. When she became unresponsive on July 16, 2010, after a blow to the head, Jonathan took her to the emergency room with injuries so severe and horrifying that one nurse physically attacked him. This is the story of a 4-year-old girl who loved the color purple, spending time with her grandparents, and finger painting. It's also the story of her torture at the hands of a sadistic young man who spent 10 days breaking Tegan's mind, body, and spirit, only stopping when her body gave out after suffering countless bruises, welts, broken bones, lacerations, and human bite marks. This is part 2 of the horrific story of Tegan Skiba. Last week, I left off in the middle of Jonathan Richardson's murder trial, during which the jury heard weeks of testimony about the torture 4-year-old Tegan endured and the unthinkable injuries left behind on her tiny body. Since I decided to split this story into 2 parts, I'll just jump right in where I left off. Once again, brace yourself, because you're going to hear even more extremely disturbing details in this episode. On March 10, 2014, Fayetteville forensic dentist Dr. Richard Barbaro took the stand at the death penalty murder trial of 25-year-old Jonathan Douglas Richardson. Dr. Barbaro testified that he was called to UNC Hospital to examine 66 bite marks all over the front and back of Tegan's body. He discussed how the severity of such wounds was graded, describing a Class 1 wound as a minor bite that likely wouldn't be very painful, and a Class 5 wound as one that tore away skin and would cause excruciating pain. He explained that the bite marks on Tegan ranged from class 2 to class 5. Dr. Barbaro testified that despite specializing in forensic odontology for 30 years,
I had never seen a child with more injuries. I had never seen a human being with more injuries than I did on Tegan's body.
I immediately said a prayer that she would die.
Jonathan was taken to Dr. Barbaro's office for dental impressions, which the dentist used to create molds to compare against Tegan's wounds.
There were bite marks with a lot of detail. The dental evidence was very, very good on the crime scene, which was Tegan's body.
The 66 bite marks he examined, in Dr. Barbaro's opinion, were consistent with Jonathan Richardson's teeth.
I could not exclude him. Everywhere I checked matched him point to point.
When the defense suggested the bite marks may have been caused by someone else, Dr. Barbaro explained,
We had 66 bite marks. I wasn't dealing with one little bite mark or partial bite mark.
I didn't have one bite mark to look at. I looked at many, many bite marks covering that little girl's body, not one. And those bite marks were good bite marks. We had 6 upper and 6 lower teeth in many cases. In some cases, we had 8 upper and 8 lower teeth.
The next day, 2 of Helen's sisters, Yuri and Myra Reyes, were called to testify, both tearfully describing their sister as kind and loving. When asked what kind of a mother Helen was to Tegan, Yuri said,
Very loving, caring, just always showing her love and hugging her and kissing her.
Myra answered the same question by saying,
She loved Tegan. She tried to better her life for Tegan.
The most severe discipline she ever saw her sister give Tegan was a timeout or a light pop on the bottom. She did see, however, Jonathan behave much more aggressively toward her niece. On one occasion, when Tegan was crying after being dropped off by her grandparents, Myra said,
and she was crying. And he went to her.
Who's he?
Jonathan. Grabbed her by her arms and shook her to stop crying.
Ms. Reyes, did you see anything? Any injuries or damage? Any kind on Tegan?
I didn't see anything on her.
Is there anything that would have caused you concern?
No.
Another witness that day was Jonathan's second cousin, Matthew Daughtry, who described Helen as being very quiet.
Jonathan would yell at Helen. It would escalate to cussing. I never saw anything physical, but there was verbal abuse.
Matthew said he was disturbed by Jonathan's treatment of their grandparents. When Wade or Helen Creech asked Jonathan to do something, Matthew said, he
would not listen. He would challenge them back. He would be very dominating over them. It came to the point where he told them to shut up. It was going to be Jonathan's way.
March 12th brought testimony from North Carolina State Crime Laboratory DNA analyst Jennifer Elwell, who told the court that Tegan's DNA was present in three spots of blood she found on a wooden rod collected from the shed, although she admitted she couldn't determine how or when the blood got on the rod. The DNA expert testified that more than 30 items seized from the shed, including underwear, pants, a sleeping bag, the wooden rod, and a pillowcase, gave chemical indications for the presence of blood. Also on the stand the same day was Dr. Jonathan Privett, Assistant Chief Medical Examiner for the North Carolina Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in Greenville, who told the jury he observed injuries to Tegan's neck that were consistent with strangulation by an electrical cord. Dr. Privett testified that although Tegan was covered with innumerable injuries, her death was caused by blunt force trauma to the head.
No, the other injuries certainly could have caused death later if they, you know, if she... they had been infected and she could have gotten septic, but the head injury is what led to the death. The skin injuries, appropriately treated, would not have caused the death.
When she came to us, the brain had been damaged so severely that, and swelling was so much, the brain matter was starting to come out.
The doctor testified that part of Tegan's skull had to be removed to relieve some of the severe swelling on her brain. He also informed the shocked courtroom that one of Tegan's nipples had been nearly ripped off, and that there were injuries present on the little girl's genitalia that he had never seen before in terms of the location and extent of the injuries. During Dr. Privett's testimony, jurors were visibly disturbed by the almost 30 photos shown of Tegan's autopsy. When the photos were shown, Gerald Skiba stood and walked out of the courtroom, while his wife, Sarah, dissolved into tears. According to reporter Kelly O'Hara, who was present in the courtroom during the trial and live-tweeted several times a day,
"Doctor is showing injuries of hashtag Tegan Skiba in the hospital. One of the alternate jurors looks like she's going to be sick. The photos that we're seeing are unimaginable. It's like they're not real. Hashtag Jonathan Richardson isn't looking at them."
Also on March 12, 2014, the jury was taken as a group to eat at a local Golden Corral restaurant. Later, they reported that a woman at the restaurant shouted at them that Jonathan Richardson was guilty and that they needed to convict him. The next morning, the defense entered a motion for mistrial as a result of the incident. Before the trial could resume, Judge Locke asked the six jurors who heard the woman's comment if they would be able to continue being fair and impartial, and each of them told the judge they would. Fortunately, the trial was allowed to proceed. On March 14th, Helen Reyes, who was still free on bail and by that time had an 8-month-old daughter, took the stand. Although her charge of felony child negligent abuse had not yet been adjudicated, Helen's testimony was reportedly not part of a plea agreement. When asked why she had chosen to testify, Helen replied,
"I am here for Tegan. I am here for my baby, for justice for her. Because that man murdered my baby."
Helen told the courtroom how much she loved her daughter and described her brief but turbulent relationship with Jonathan Richardson, who she met at a nightclub. She was initially charmed by the handsome, well-mannered Southerner, saying,
"I cared about him. I felt I was in love with him, or falling in love with him."
Before long, cracks began to appear in her boyfriend's facade. During one incident, Jonathan was babysitting Tegan while Helen went to the store, and she came home to find a cut on Tegan's head.
"He told me that he had whipped her for throwing up on his chair. He had whipped her with a power cord."
Helen said she almost broke up with Jonathan over it, but ultimately stayed with him.
And I went inside. And I grabbed her, and I held her, and I told her I loved her, and asked, was she okay? I was angry. I was outraged. I was ready to leave. I wanted to go. I told him never to touch Tegan, to discipline her like that.
Several months before Tegan's death, Helen said, she tried to end her relationship with Jonathan. She read the jury part of a love letter she wrote to him around the same time.
If I tell you I love you too much, then tell me, and I'll tone it down. You have shown me what it means to be truly loved and treated well.
Jonathan sat, stone-faced and emotionless, as Helen read aloud from the letter. The jury saw photos of Tegan, smiling and happy, juxtaposed with photos showing the little girl with a black eye that prosecutors said was caused by Jonathan about a month before her death. Jonathan told her the injury was caused at the beach.
He told me there was a wave that came and ended up hitting her eye.
Prosecutor Butler asked Helen why she stayed with Jonathan despite his abuse of her daughter, and she replied,
he was stern with her at times, but he showed that he loved and cared for her.
He interacted with her as a father figure. He would try to teach her to fish.
Helen told the jury she regretted entrusting Jonathan with Tegan's care while she attended Army training in New Mexico. Because she and her mother had a falling out, she said, Jonathan volunteered to care for Tegan while she was gone, telling Helen his grandmother would watch the little girl while he was at work.
I trusted him, and I trusted his word. She said she really liked him, and that she wanted him to be her dad.
That was the first time during the trial that Jonathan Richardson showed a modicum of emotion, wiping at his reddening eyes.
I know I was wrong for leaving her behind. I never thought that I would come home or get a phone call that something was severely wrong with my baby. I live with this every day of my life. I miss her every single day.
The jury was shocked when prosecutors showed a photo of Tegan sitting in the front seat of a car near a pack of Marlboros and a can of Budweiser beer, her eyes half closed and a cigarette hanging from her lips. Two jurors even covered their mouths with their hands. Helen explained that the photo was taken while the three of them were on a trip to Carolina Beach, adding,
I told him not to do that to her.
Johnston County Sheriff's Investigator Michael Lambert testified on March 17th that at about 2 a.m. on July 16th, 2010, the same day Tegan was admitted to the hospital, Jonathan was captured on security video purchasing first aid supplies at Walmart. Investigator Lambert told the court that there was no sign of Tegan in that security video, nor in multiple other security videos taken during the days prior, which showed Jonathan purchasing items like beer and an air mattress. During that time, it is believed that Tegan was left alone, locked into the shed, and likely restrained. The next day, Dr. Kenya McNeil Trice, a pediatrician at UNC Hospital who specialized in child physical and sexual abuse, spent the entire day on the stand. The doctor told the jury that some of the injuries Tegan suffered were consistent with sexual abuse. Near the end of the day, some visibly shaken jurors and court personnel wept while the state played for them a 37-second video filmed at 2:31 a.m. on July 10, 2010, 9 days before Tegan's death. Prosecutors said the video was the last image of Tegan both conscious and alive. In the video, Tegan, wearing a pink shirt, faced a wall with her bruised, broken arms outstretched, begging Jonathan not to hurt her anymore, crying out over and over,
when I have to pee, I promise I will tell someone.
Her tormentor's response in the video was to shout,
speak up,
and the little girl repeated the phrase 4 more times. At the conclusion of the traumatizing video, the prosecution rested its case after 17 days of testimony by multiple witnesses. The defense began presenting its case on March 19, 2014. Several witnesses testified about Jonathan's demeanor on the day of his arrest. A video was played in court, although the judge did not allow the jury to be present while it was shown, ruling the video was hearsay, as only one side of the phone conversation being recorded was audible. The video, filmed in a police interrogation room, portrayed Jonathan making a phone call to Helen, telling his girlfriend he loved Tegan to death. Because of the recording quality, it's hard to discern what Jonathan said during much of the phone call, so I will quote pertinent passages after you hear some of the recording.
I wanted to have a kid with you when you got home because I love being around her so much. I love her to death, Ellen, I do. And I would never do anything to push her further.
Jonathan told his girlfriend,
I wanted to have kids with you when you got home because I loved being around her so much. I loved her to death, Helen. I do. And I would never do anything to intentionally hurt her.
She's never had a father. In the way she's loved up to me, she loved me so much.
He said he wanted to be a family with Helen and Tegan.
She's never had a father, and the way she's warmed up to me, she loves me so much.
You know that my mind is messed up, don't you? You've even said.
He made excuses.
You know my mind is messed up, don't you? You've even said.
Helen, I just want to believe that I didn't mean to do it. And that I didn't hurt her head.
He also insisted that Tegan's fatal injury was not his doing.
Helen, I just want to tell you I didn't mean to do it, and I didn't hurt her head.
On Thursday, March 20th, 2014, forensic psychiatrist Dr. Donna Schwartz-Watts testified as an expert for the defense, saying several undiagnosed mental disorders may have led to Jonathan's actions. After the defendant's arrest, the doctor said she determined that he likely suffered from unspecified anxiety disorder, mood disorder, and substance abuse disorder. While Tegan was in his care, the doctor said, Jonathan was 21 and had a history of alcohol and drug abuse, and he also had endured improper punishment from his own father, who she said was a strict disciplinarian who had frequently whipped Jonathan with a belt. Jonathan did not, she said, suffer from post-traumatic stress in July of 2010. While caring for Tegan, she said,
he was irritable. He was in a situation where he was punishing a child. He has no experience raising children. He's been punished in the past with affect and anger. He's punishing her for not listening to him, but in terms of his anxiety disorder, it's not related.
Closing arguments began on March 24, 2014. During his emotional closing statement, Assistant District Attorney Paul Jackson reminded the jury that Jonathan spent 10 days torturing, sexually assaulting, and beating his girlfriend's daughter while Helen was out of state, training for the Army Reserves. He acknowledged that the jurors had witnessed unthinkably brutal testimony and evidence during the trial, and that it had undoubtedly changed everyone in the room.
The law enforcement officers who investigated this case and were exposed to what this defendant did will never, ever be the same. The state will never be the same. And you can't be the same. And that's because that our duty and our responsibility has demanded something of us that we would not wish on our worst enemy. It has demanded that we all look into the abyss, that in our hearts we don't want to exist, that we wish didn't exist. You don't want to imagine it. Of course you don't. And it's hard to think about, and you don't want to think about it, and your reaction and your reflex is just to hide it. To not think about it. The multiple and continuous sadistic acts, the heinous, atrocious, cruel acts that came from a dark place, you don't want to think about it. You wish that that didn't exist, but it does. And you, ladies and gentlemen, can't be the same because you have glimpsed into that abyss and that darkness and the horrible, horrible thing that we wish didn't exist on this earth, but it does. And so don't forget what this case is about. And it's hard and it's difficult. And we demand of you, ladies and gentlemen, awful things. Because you know what? As awful and dark and horrendous as it is, it gets worse because it was committed against this little girl. And so your instinct, your preservation instinct, your human instinct is to not think about that. Not think about the aftermath. You don't want to think about it because your mind, as a human being, you don't want to think about the fact her brain is so damaged and swollen it's going down her neck. I'm sorry, you don't want to think about that. Of course you don't. But we've got a duty and a responsibility to not only think about the aftermath, and you saw the rest of her body mangled, pieces of skin missing. You don't want to think about that. But we have to because what this case is about. And I'm going to ask you when defense counsel gets up and they're talking to you, and they're talking to you about things other than what happened, other than why we're here, I want you to please remember why we're here, because it's not just about the aftermath. And you've got to think about not just the aftermath, but what she went through on those 10 days. No, you don't want to think about it. It's unimaginable. The only one who really knows how much agony and suffering Tegan went through was Tegan as it was happening. And this defendant. 10 days of continuous torment, torture, and terror. And you don't want to think about it, but you have to. Because that's what the case is about. As we get up and we argue to you, talk to you about the law. When this honor instructs you on the law, you have to apply it to these 10 days. What happened in those 10 days? The evidence is uncontroverted. So there's no real doubt about the heinous and atrocious injuries that he inflicted upon Tegan. The only opportunity she had is when Miss Helen Creech came, knocked on the door, and he said, "Put that goddamn door!" This case, you know, is not about what happened to the defendant when he was in kindergarten. It's not about Helen, and her day will come. But he committed these acts. She was in New Mexico. Did she choose a man over her child? Yes. Should she have left him with him? No. Should she be responsible for that? Yes. But when you start thinking you're letting that hatred for her start interfering with your analysis of what this defendant did, that's wrong. Their own expert testified that, oh, he was a little bit irritable, that nothing that she saw lessened his culpability at all, that he knew the difference between right and wrong. Remember, that's their evidence. These claims that they made, you know, this case is not about whether or not the defendant's mom was charged with murder in 1991 and acquitted. What does that have to do with these 10 days? Keep your eye on the ball. I know that you want to forget what this defendant did to Tegan. I know you want to. It's human nature. I know you don't want to think about it. I know you don't want to think about the suffering and the unthinkable, because it is unthinkable. Promise me you will not forget about what this is about, those 10 days, and this little girl, and what she went through. I know you want to forgive, but it's not time. We still have work to do.
Defense attorney Jonathan Brown, during his closing argument, insisted his client did not intend to kill Tegan, saying Jonathan had shaken Tegan hard enough to injure her brain and then waited too long to get her medical attention. Even though the little girl suffered injuries to her genital and anal area, he said, Jonathan did not have sexual intent toward Tegan. He asked the jury to consider Jonathan's undiagnosed mental issues and the abuse he supposedly endured from his father as a child.
Everything about this case is so incredibly tragic. Everything about the death of Tegan is so upsetting. Everything about this is so incredibly sad. And if we all weren't involved in it, we would react with disgust, anger, and even hatred. But you all have been given a duty and a responsibility to decide this case, to determine exactly what happened, to apply the law to the facts. This means you have to go beyond your natural and understandable instincts about what happened. There are hard questions that have to be answered, facts that have to be analyzed, and law that has to be applied to this case.
The defense concluded that Tegan's head injury resulted from Jonathan, frustrated, shaking the little girl with
incredible force,
causing her to hit her head on a door. This, they contended, did not meet the criteria for a first-degree murder conviction. Defense attorney Klinkosum said,
"Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that what happened to Tegan Skeeble was okay, or that it wasn't horrible. It was horrible. But ladies and gentlemen, what happened to her the whip marks and the bitings and everything else that you heard about, all of that terrible stuff, as bad as it was, and I'm not telling you it's not bad, it's awful. But as bad as it was, ladies and gentlemen, what actually ended her life was a blow to the head. It was blunt force trauma to the head that caused her brain to swell. It was one quick action, one quick force that ended her life. As you heard the doctors say, all of the doctors testified that the marks on her, the bite marks, the strap, the ligature mark, the strap marks, all of that, as bad as it was not what ended her life. It was that blow to the head.
Prosecutor Jackson was not moved by the defense's claims, saying there was nothing that could mitigate Jonathan Richardson's culpability.
It's easy to forget what this is about when you listen to them talk about really what is no defense. A case in which they have no defense, according to their own expert, that nothing minimizes his culpability. He knew what he was doing was wrong. He was irritable. Her name is Tegan Skiba. And that's how you want to remember. That's how you want to remember, with the gleam in the eyes, the smile, that age when innocence is real and magic exists and the world is enchanted. That's how we want to remember. And there will come a time when you can. But now is not the time. Because we still have a responsibility and we still have a duty. She's not here, but we are here for her. Set aside that human instinct. You know, Mr. Klingelson talks about don't want you to make decisions based upon emotions, based upon sympathy. And I'm not asking you to do that. Because really, your human nature, your instinct is to say, I don't want to live in a world where this can happen. And I'm sorry, you have to look at it. As much as you don't want to. And that's your instinct to say, please let there be some other explanation other than the darkness that is inside of him. The sadistic thing that he needed to satisfy. Was it lack of experience that made him bite her nipple off? Lack of parenting experience that caused him to bite chunks of her skin off? Over 60 human bite marks? Irritability? This case is about these days. From July 5th until July 16th, when the only thing that Tegan Skiba knew was this defendant. That was the world she was confined in. And so that is where you have to look at the facts. That is where you apply the law. And I tell you what, there was no breaking the chain for Tegan Skiba as she's in there, in that shed, in that torture chamber, waiting for him to come back, knowing that the abuse is going to begin again. There was no breaking the chain. There was one thing that broke the chain, and that is when the defendant destroyed her brain. And in this case, the only way that you can find this defendant not guilty is through fantastic leaps of the imagination. The only way that you can find him not guilty is if you check your common sense at the door, and I know you won't do it. Just think about it.
The jury was sent home after Monday's closing arguments. Jurors returned the following day to begin deliberations, and they returned just over an hour later with a verdict. Jonathan Douglas Richardson was found guilty on all four charges. His sentencing hearing would be held the following day. At Jonathan's sentencing hearing, which took place over the course of multiple days, forensic pediatrician Dr. Sharon Cooper testified that Tegan's injuries were
textbook examples
of torture.
She had 144 injuries. That is an extraordinarily high number, and these are not the type of injuries that would typically occur with a one-time loss of control.
Contradicting the defense's assertion that Jonathan simply became angry and lashed out at Tegan, Dr. Cooper testified that the little girl suffered abuse every day during those 10 days in July of 2010, and that Jonathan victimized her using physical, psychological, and sexual abuse.
It's very deliberate and systematic and is meant to cause both mental and physical suffering. A person takes time to set up what they're going to do. This is not a sudden loss of control. This is a calculated form of abuse.
Dr. Matthew Mendel, a forensic psychologist who met with Jonathan several times after his arrest, testified on Jonathan's behalf, saying the convicted killer told him Tegan called him Daddy, and that while in jail, he tattooed her name and birth date on his arm.
I asked him, "How do you feel about Helen?" He said, "I still care about her, but that's not why I did the tattoos. I did this because it was a life-changing event. I lost my daughter."
I concluded that there's a lot of mystery involved with Jonathan Richardson and with his family more generally, and frankly, I had more difficulty finding out information.
He's certainly quite disturbed, but that he comes from a family in which there is a great deal of disturbance as well, and that I believe the family disturbance is very central and critical to understanding Jonathan's psychological disturbance.
When Dr. Mendel was cross-examined by the prosecution, they had him read from jailhouse reports documenting some of Jonathan's bad behavior in jail, where he was given mood-stabilizing medication and subjected to frequent lockdowns. One lieutenant wrote,
"We do not know what to do with him. We keep locking him down, but it does no good."
Judge Locke disallowed testimony about certain behaviors from being heard by the jury, saying it would be highly prejudicial. With the jury out of the room, Dr. Mendel read from the report that Jonathan threw feces and urine and
incited other inmates to do his dirty work.
He also threatened to stab a detention officer. An item discovered in Jonathan's cell while he was in court that afternoon only bolstered his image as a violent, disorderly inmate. Another prisoner notified a detention officer of a concern. During his search, Captain James Jarrell testified the following morning, he discovered a handmade shank, or rudimentary weapon.
Found a toothbrush wrapped up with some cloth, had a fingernail file attached to the end of it, and it was underneath a towel at the entrance at the cell of the door.
In court on Wednesday morning, ADA Butler asked Judge Locke to order Jonathan to wear shackles, saying,
"We'd ask the court impose some restrictions. As personnel, we're concerned for our safety."
Judge Locke ordered Jonathan to wear leg shackles for the remainder of his trial
to prevent the defendant's escape and ensure safety of court personnel.
When the judge asked Jonathan if he had anything to say, the convicted killer replied,
"I'd like to see it on camera."
He may have been referring to security video of the search in his cell. Another witness at sentencing was Doug Richardson's longtime live-in girlfriend, Sandy Penny, who contradicted the defense's claims that Jonathan's father was a rageful man, saying Doug was a good father and she never saw any signs of improper punishment toward his son.
He would spank him, and I can tell you, count on one hand how many times he got a spanking. I mean, we all get angry and we all yell, but he is not an angry man.
He's a very loving, fun man. He was a good dad, and they had a good father-son relationship. Jonathan had a good home. He had the best of both worlds. He had his mom every other weekend. He had his dad every day. And the other weekends, they went fishing all the time. All the time.
Victim impact statements were allowed during sentencing, during which Helen Reyes' sister, Myra, said,
"I'm just ready for this to be over. I hate that this wound in my heart had to be reopened."
Paternal grandmother Sarah Skiba said,
"There is so much sadness, anger, disbelief, heartache every day of our lives. We try to remember the happy times we shared with Tegan, but are so saddened that there will be no more."
During closing arguments for the sentencing phase, Assistant District Attorney Greg Butler said,
"The defendant decided her fate. On July 16, 2010, he ultimately became her sole judge, jury, and executioner. Life in prison, I contend to you, is a slap on the wrist. Justice demands that he receive no better fate than he gave Tegan."
During his closing argument, Attorney Jonathan Brown pointed out the possible 46 mitigating factors when asking the jury,
"Why did his desire to have the perfect family turn so tragic? We know this did not happen in a vacuum. We just can't simply say some people are just mean and not look for the real answers. What happened to Tegan is beyond horrible, beyond tragic, and is completely senseless. These obviously are not the crimes of a healthy person."
ADA Butler countered this argument, saying of the convicted,
"He wants you to feel sad. He wants you to be concerned for him and his self-described horrible life. He wants you to have sympathy for him and forget this terrible, senseless, needless, vicious crime that he committed against a little 4-year-old girl, Tegan Skiba. All this is just to get your attention taken away from what he did, how he did it, and who he did it to and why."
Defense Attorney Mike Klinkosum said during his closing argument,
"We're not asking you to forgive Mr. Richardson for what he did. Life in prison without parole is not forgiveness. It is its own abyss. A life condemned to prison for someone convicted of a sexual assault and torturous murder of a 4-year-old girl is a special kind of abyss. It's a special kind of hell. There will never come a time when he can let his guard down."
Some jurors wept as District Attorney Susan Doyle again showed the 37-second video of Tegan facing the wall with her injured arms outstretched, repeating,
"When I have to pee, I promise I will tell someone."
We know from this evidence that you have heard that Tegan Skiba was a very tough little girl. We know that despite the torture that the defendant inflicted upon her day in and day out, that she continued to will herself to survive. Even after the defendant bound her, gagged her, locked her in a shed over and over, she had a will to survive. Even after the defendant whipped her repeatedly with a drop cord, leaving marks all over her body, she still had a will to survive. And even after the defendant whipped her with such force that those metal fragments from that drop cord broke off and became embedded underneath her skin, all over her body, she still had a will to survive. And after the defendant sexually abused her and caused so much trauma to her little body, she still had a will to survive. And then we get to July 10th. That was the day that the video was made. And if you remember, this is 5 days into Tegan's torture. And we know this because of what we could see in that video. If I have to pee, I promise I will tell someone. And it was amazing that she was able to even do just that after the torture that she had already been through. It was amazing that she was able to say what she was supposed to say. Even after the defendant yelled at her, she stayed on script. She appeared to be really trying to do whatever she needed to do, not to be injured again. She was a tough little girl. But this tough little girl, as tough as Tegan Skiba was no match for that defendant. She was no match for his persistent and his calculated and his carefully planned acts of torture. Because in addition to everything else that he had already done, the defendant bit Tegan all over her body over 60 times. And she began to slip away. Tegan had lost 70% of the blood from her body. And the doctors told you that it wasn't because of the head injury, but instead it was due to all the wounds, all the whips and the cuts and the bites that the defendant had inflicted upon Tegan. So she slowly began to bleed out there in that shed. And as she began her slow, torturous death, she was in this dark, dirty, lonely place. She was in this shed all alone, and she had no one with her. She had no one to help her. She had no one to care for her. And she had no one to comfort her but him. Her tormentor, her terrorizer, and her torturer is all she had those last days of her life. I am confident that your sentence will speak the truth. Your sentence will finally bring justice for Tegan. And your sentence will allow her family to begin to put away some of this pain and to once again remember the sweet little girl who in happier times loved to say, "It's a sunny day. Let's play."
The prosecutors worked hard to rein in their emotions during their closing statements, their voices quivering at times. There was no doubt they would forever be changed. On Thursday, April 3, 2014, the jury was sent to deliberate at around 4:30 p.m., and shortly after 8 p.m. the same day, they returned with their decision.
"We, the jury, unanimously recommend that the defendant, Jonathan Douglas Richardson, be sentenced to death."
Once condemned to death, 25-year-old Jonathan Douglas Richardson gave no reaction, and he was led from the courtroom in handcuffs. His mother, Sandy Creech, and his grandmother, Helen Creech, remained in the courtroom, quietly weeping. Sandy spoke with a reporter off-camera, saying,
"I understand the anger and bitterness, because I feel it too, after what happened to Tegan. But he's still my son, and I love him dearly, and he needs me now more than ever. I'm in disbelief that the Jonathan I know could do this. I have to forgive him, not for him, but for myself. I hope the community can do the same. There's a lot of healing that needs to be done. That will come with time and faith in God."
Sandy had never met Tegan and had no idea her son was caring for a child at the time of Tegan's death. She had a message for Tegan's family, saying,
"Words cannot express how sorry I am that this happened. My heart goes out to them and the pain they've had to go through. I can't imagine what they've gone through. I'm just so sorry. I just didn't know. I had no idea that Tegan was there. I just didn't know. I just had no idea. I would have done something had I only known, and I'm hoping they can heal, because I know the pain is horrible for them, and has been."
The reporter spoke briefly with Tegan's paternal grandfather, her papa Gerald, who said,
"Still doesn't help bring our TV back, you know, which is something that'll be painful the rest of our lives. The way I see it, he got the verdict today. He should be dead tomorrow. That's my look at it, you know, because he tortured my little granddaughter, and she's never coming back again, you know. He made that decision. He should have to suffer for it immediately."
Gerald added,
"They got the best they could do. He already lived 3.5 years longer than my granddaughter, and now they're going to give him another 7 or 8 years. It's like his life is more important than her. She just wanted people to love her, and she just showed her love so freely. And then somebody like that just comes in and just tortures her, you know, hurt her, and that's, I don't know. It's hard to put into words."
Jonathan's death sentence was automatically appealed. He apparently continued to fight his conviction and sentence, although it's weirdly difficult to find any information on his efforts. In 2015, an amicus brief was filed with the North Carolina Supreme Court in an attempt to call attention to details Jonathan and his team of attorneys felt hadn't been adequately addressed at trial. The 528-page document focused on the inadmissibility of bite mark comparison evidence and attempted to have Dr. Barbaro's testimony about the bite marks thrown out. Since there is next to no information available about the results of that attempt, I can only assume it went nowhere. In September of 2014, the same year his grandson was sentenced to death, Wade Sidney Creech died at the age of 79. Surprisingly, Jonathan Richardson was mentioned in the list of surviving relatives. On a brighter note, in June of 2017, the Johnston County District Attorney's Office announced that the county courthouse was welcoming North Carolina's first courthouse facility dog, a beautiful young golden doodle named Tegan. Multiple local businesses signed up to cover the dog's adoption costs and training classes, and a local veterinarian agreed to provide all of her veterinary and grooming care. Puppy Tegan's responsibilities would include comforting and supporting child and adult witnesses and victims while they gave difficult testimony. District Attorney Susan Doyle said,
"Children in particular will benefit from Tegan's ability to provide emotional support as they confront the tragic details of abuse they have suffered in the past. We hope Tegan can help our office promote justice through compassion by providing comfort and lots of love to those in need. After much discussion in our office and with the blessing of Tegan Skiba's grandparents, We could think of no better way to honor her memory. In February of 2019, Helen Reyes pleaded guilty to a Class E felony charge of child abuse, thereby admitting she displayed reckless disregard for the welfare of the child, resulting in serious bodily injury. The following month, she was sentenced to spend 18 to 31 months in prison, of which she ultimately spent 2 years and 7 months in the North Carolina Correctional Institute for Women in Raleigh, before being released on parole in September of 2020. At the time of her sentencing, Helen was also recommended for substance abuse treatment, although it's unclear if she complied with that recommendation. Helen's parole ended in May of 2021, and Helen, who is now 38 years old, is a free woman. The North Carolina Department of Corrections website lists Helen's current location as Maryland. Although capital punishment is a legal penalty under North Carolina law, the state has not executed anyone in about 15 years. Various lawsuits filed throughout the state calling into question the death penalty's usage have caused an unofficial moratorium on executions. The last execution in North Carolina took place in 2006, when 36-year-old Samuel Flippin was put to death via lethal injection. Jonathan Douglas Richardson, North Carolina Department of Corrections offender number 101-9362, is currently incarcerated at Central Prison in Raleigh. In October of 2021, Jonathan racked up his first prison infraction by threatening to harm or injure prison staff. I guess at this point, he figures he has nothing left to lose. I don't like to wish harm on anyone, but I truly hope that for the rest of his miserable life, no matter how long that may be, Jonathan Richardson feels as hopeless as Tegan must have during her final days. He deserves nothing less. I'd like to end this two-part episode by remembering Tegan not just for the horrific way she died, but as the sweet, loving little girl she was. According to her obituary, Tegan Alyssa Skiba loved the color purple, her grandma's garden, and both ladybugs and butterflies. In fact, she loved purple so much that her papa, Gerald, managed to find and fill her sandbox with purple sand. Tegan also loved reading her books, swimming in the pool, and going on outings with her grandparents to local farms and the zoo. She also enjoyed playing with the many soccer balls her papa, a soccer coach, kept around. She had a special blanket she liked to cart around with her, a soft purple throw blanket covered with the faces of the various Disney princesses. On Tegan's obituary page, Gerald wrote this touching remembrance. "Tegi, when you left us, it felt by you leaving, half of my heart was taken too. It hurts so much, every day. The pool is not the same without you, your rock with your name on it, your flower bed. Every Saturday morning, your first words, 'The sun is shining, it's a sunny day.' Then you would want Papa or Grandma to make you maple oatmeal so you could go outside and play with Papa in the pool. Play with the pink car her dad, Jerry, got for her. She outgrew it, but wouldn't stop playing with it. Then play with the soccer balls later. Tegan loved art, finger painting, making things with her different colored clay. We had so many great times. Grandma and I couldn't wait to see you. Being around you made us so happy. We miss you, Tegan. Our Tegi." Tegan's maternal aunt, Judy Reyes, also wrote a message on the obituary page, saying, "I remember the day you was born. I waited all night for your arrival. The minute you came, I was speechless. You was this little tiny precious niña. When I looked at you, I seen little Helen. You had stolen my heart with your little big nose and your little laughter. I was always by your side when you cried, fell, and fought with your cousins. I'm going to miss your little voice calling me Juju and kissing me with your wet little lips. My heart hurts because your little tiny self is not here with us anymore. Tegi, I miss you dearly. I wish I could have been there when you needed me the most. Nanny and Jassy miss you very much. I know in my heart that we will meet again so that I can hug you and kiss you. Until then, you will always remain in my heart and my thoughts. I love you dearly, Tegi." Another family member, who signed their memory as Cousin Connie, wrote,
"The moment I laid eyes on you, you reminded me of a little porcelain doll. You were so little, and also a crybaby. You would only let me hold you just a little bit until you started crying for your mother. Boy, did you love your mother. You only had eyes for her."
Maternal aunt Myra wrote,
"You were incredibly smart, beautiful, amazing in every way, athletic and a little fighter. I just want you to know that every time I think about you and all the fun we had together, that beautiful smile, it just lightens my day more than ever. Waking up every morning to, 'Aya, look, it's a sunny day, it's time to get up, and just seeing your pretty face next to mine just started my day great. I remember when you called to say that your name was Pam Olivia, and you had me laughing. Just know that I love you more than anything in this world, and that you will never be forgotten, and I'm always going to miss you. My sources for this episode were the In Memory of Angel Tegan Skiba Facebook community, WRAL-TV, the North Carolina Department of Corrections website, The Daily Mail, The Obscura Podcast, ABC 7, Dignity Memorial, ABC 30 Action News, Find a Grave, Fox 8, Narchive, Court Documents, The Raleigh News and Observer, The Reality Chatter Forums, The JusticeForKaylee.net Forums, The Johnston County Report, WX11, Wikipedia, and The Parish Funeral Home. That's it for this week. Join me next week for another story. If you like the show, please follow or subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, Spreaker, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. And please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. Visit the website at sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes or become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to bonus content and exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter and TikTok at STLCPod. View photos related to today's episode on Facebook and Instagram. For more stories like the one you heard today, visit sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast is researched, written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. All music for the show is licensed from audiojungle.net. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. For more information about preventing or reporting child abuse, visit childhelp.org or call your area's child abuse hotline. If you see something, say something. Until next week, bye everyone.